purposely avoided defining it for you, and I'm not even really going to define it for you now, and I think...
Kev, is your microphone on?
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's a switch on the side.
Yeah, that switch.
The top has to say mic, and the side has to say on.
Okay, so on and mic.
And there's a little green thing, is that it?
It's working now, yep, I can hear you.
Okay, so forget what I just said. Okay, so...
We already did.
Yeah, it's not going to be in the final. All right, so let's see if we can put this all together. There are a number of themes that have run through all of this, and what I'm going to do later on is give you a handout from Plato's Timaeus, of all things. It has nothing to do with Christianity or Judaism or Islam, but nonetheless shows you Western thinking about this concept. All right, so... At basis, what we're talking about is another world. Right? At basis, we're talking about another world. And this other world is different from this one in a number of particulars. For example, this one has a lot of change. This one has a lot of variation. This one has a lot of fortune, fate, right? All those things that you think define you, but they don't. All right, so the human imagination, it must have been 160, 200,000 years ago, started working on this. The theory is that since we start sleeping at sunset, which is what you should be doing, you're going to wake up about 2 in the morning. Does that sound familiar to anybody? This is the monastic.
My father does that.
You have a good for your father in Thomas Edison. But this is the monastic round, right? So nocturne started at 2 in the morning. Well, there's nothing you can do until sunrise except think. So here is a primitive animal, or an animal way back when, that's already starting to imagine what life is like. And what does he or she have in front of him but the stars? And what do the stars tell you? The stars tell you that there's such a thing as perfection. And this perfection takes a geometrical form, and that is the circle. Okay, so the circle becomes a symbol. I've been using it to show you the height and depth of human experience, right? But it also becomes, obviously, weddings and things like that, a symbol of eternity. Right. This is not going to exhaust itself. We don't even have to go to a Möbius strip. We can just see that. So watching the sky circle around the North Pole becomes a metaphor for these people of what life could be like without leopards, without disease, without miscarriage, all those things that we consider evil. Right. So already people are thinking about this in this dream time, which is sacred for most people, this time when you're awake and yet you can't do anything, this time when you have to meditate. So we get already this concept of meditation. Way back when, right? Meditation, basically thinking about some object, usually a tangible physical object like the sky, or tangible one, physical, but trying to figure out a greater meaning for it. All right? And this greater meaning has to do with something that is good rather than evil. And we define good in this class. It wasn't exactly a definition that Plato would have liked, because for him, good was an absolute. But for this class, good was that which fit. Right? That which fit. But anyway, that's what people have been since, I believe, they've been conscious. I believe since they've had language. Because when you think about language, what do you have? You have a word that is better than any particular exercise of that word. Right? If I say the stars, I'm talking about something that's better than an individual star or even an individual night. Right? Okay, so... We have consciousness, language, and religion all put together at the same time, simultaneously. So, and this thing is real for all these people that you're going to be running into in your careers. All these people, this is real, right? In fact, Black Elk talks about the great Sioux medicine man, talks about the fact that the world he sees with the six grandfathers, which are Cartesian coordinates, north, south, east, west, up, down, right? He says this was more real than what the Sioux were going through in the late 19th century. That is when they were being subject to genocide. Right? And they knew it. They knew what was happening to them. All right, so he says, I now saw that what was happening on Earth was not real. What was real was where the six grandfathers were looking down on my people. Right? So the thing that I've been calling transcendence, that's what it's all about. Right? And it's in each one of you. Whether you believe you have a soul or not, it's in each one of you that you have this urge to transcend, to make yourself better, to make yourself more real. Right? And you can see how Eckhart is doing this by saying, get rid of all the things that really aren't you. Your height, your weight, your gender, your name. Get rid of all those things. Right? And he says, if you can do that, if you can detach, then you'll get to reality. Okay? So the first and foremost concept in this class was this notion of a mystical experience being an experience in reality, right? Whether you want to call it a union with God or, as Eckhart says, God's union with you, doesn't really matter, because that's taking your sense of what God is into the equation, and that's going to cause problems. So leave that out and just say, what is more real? And that's part of the mystical experience. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is that this now changes the way you live on Earth. And that's why I made you, for your papers, have a practical section. Right? That this isn't something that you just experience in dream time or in vision. You notice there are no ecstasies in any of the readings that we did, of any of the three religions. No ecstasies. Right? But you now have a responsibility to bring it down into your lives. Right? And every spiritual being, right, Buddhist or Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu, is about this, is about taking whatever the experience of true reality is and bringing it into everything we do every day. Okay, the third thing is that by doing this, we will eventually become that. Right? By taking this reality, you notice we have a circle here again. By taking this reality that we experience up here, bringing it down into our lives, that we'll do this. And often this means transcending death. Not necessarily, but since we're really obsessed with death, that's what it's about. Right? That we're all, in some way, even as young as you are, concerned about death, especially when it's somebody we know, and we suddenly say, how did this happen? You know, they were only 20, and they were killed. Right? So we get back and we have joined the six grandfathers, according to Black Elk. Now, it doesn't matter what happens to the Sioux. We are beyond that. All right? So those three categories, I think, best describe not only medieval mysticism, not only mysticism, but spirituality in general. Right? This attachment, this interest in to this, even obsession with a reality beyond what we consider to be physical, right? Because the physical seems to be unsatisfactory as a way of living. Right? And then an attempt to bring back that sense of perfection, of transcendence into the lives that we live right now. As Augustine says, the only second that's real is this one right now. The past is gone, the future isn't here yet. So what happens right now? What do I do right now? And this gets into morality and ethics, obviously. And then the last component is, through that exercise, to become different, to become like the gods. Right. Okay, so let me hand out this little thing from the Timaeus, as if it were your final, which, as I've said, your final will be from Hildegard. But if I can show you how already Plato and Socrates were trying to do that very thing. I know, Joseph, usually I just keep chatting with the students, but since this is my last lecture, I decided to do something just a smidgen more formal, but maybe more informative at the same time. Okay, the wisdom of the Timaeus, and this is not accidental that I'm giving you. Oh, you guys should have had it, taken a copy. I made enough for everybody. Go on, pass them over. If you're going to be here, you're prepared for. Okay, the Timaeus is the only Platonic dialogue that was read in the Middle Ages. All the rest were lost. They weren't revived until much later when Lorenzo the Magnificent had Ficino start to translate Plato into Latin. And that's the end of the 15th century. Right, but this is the only one. And this is, for the people in the Middle Ages, the most critical one. Right. The things about the Republic, I think they would have not found interesting. But this one, they would have found very interesting. They did find it very interesting. Look at the way he proceeds. And you'll see a lot of Hildegard. You'll see a lot of Eckhart. You'll see a lot of the Kabbalists. You'll see a lot of Rumi. All wrapped up in the way Plato proceeds. What is that which always is and has no becoming? Okay, becoming means change. Change, we think, is a good thing if it goes to a good thing. If it goes to a bad thing, then we don't like it. So in the end, we prize a steady state that is good. In the end, that is what we most admire, is a steady state. So for the Platonists and for people in the Middle Ages, it was being that was the critical issue. It was the ground for everything else. All right. That which is appended by intelligence and reason is always in the same state. Is that? You got a place down there. Right? But that which is conceived by opinion with the help of sensation and without reason is always in a process of becoming and perishing and never really is. So the world of the senses in Plato is not privileged. It is held in suspicion. Now everything that becomes or is created must of necessity be created by some cause. This is pure Greek philosophy. For without a cause, nothing can be created. The work of the creator, whenever he looks to the unchangeable and fashions the form and nature of his work after an unchangeable pattern, must necessarily be made fair and perfect. But when he looks to the created only and uses a created pattern, it is not fair or perfect. So the creator is the real. And we're down here in a world of change, of becoming. Right? Becoming is an opportunity, but it's also a curse. Right? We're becoming sick. We're becoming tired. We're becoming all sorts of things, as well as becoming better. All right, so you can see how people in the Middle Ages would just look at that and say, this man is inspired. This man is inspired that he's already figured out that the Creator is fair, that is beautiful and perfect. Now, Timaeus goes one step further. He says, let me tell you why the Creator made this world of generation. Something that science never does. It never talks about why. He was good, and the good can never have any jealousy of anything. Being free from jealousy, he desired that all things should be like himself as they could be. So he wants, and this is pure Eckhart, he wants you to join him. Or Eckhart would say he wants him to join you. But the point is, here it is. This is in the truest sense, the origin of creation of the world, as we should do well in believing the testimony of wise men. God desired that all things should be good and nothing bad, so far insofar as this is attainable. And we had long discussions about evil. But here it is, God desiring only good. No evil, no plagues, no earthquakes, no volcanoes. It's all there. All right. So, wherefore, also finding the whole visible sphere not at rest, but moving in a regular and disorderly fashion, out of disorder he brought order. And this is an aspect of the mystical thinking, that there's a privileging of order. Right. That there's a dislike for order. The God who creates in Genesis looks over disorder and makes it into order. He divides things. There's chaos before, and he makes it into order. And we resist order, we've said this in class, mostly because we find it dangerous as a trap, that order is a bad thing. But you can see how if we have this kind of order that brings about freedom, we're talking about a very good thing. Now, the deeds of the best could never have been, never be or never been other than the fairest. And the Creator, reflecting on these things which are by nature visible, found that no unintelligent creature taken as a whole was fairer than the intelligent taken as a whole. Here's the Platonic ladder again, that the unintelligent creature, created creature, the rock, is not in any way superior to the intelligent one who can understand this relationship and respond to it. So, for which reason, when he was framing the universe, he put intelligence and soul and body, that he might be the creator of a work which was by nature fairest and best. Wherefore, using the language of probability, I think you'd like that, we may say that the world became a living creature truly endowed with soul and intelligence by the providence of God. So here is the modern Gaia theory, that the earth is alive, that the earth is this complex, not only of living things, but itself is alive. Right? And what the Timaeus is going to do in subsequent paragraphs is say the human being reflects that perfection, even to being a globe. So all of you know Da Vinci's Perfect Man and how it fits within a circle. Right? So the artist is saying that we are circles, right? That we're captured in the eternity and the perfection of a circle. All right, so I won't keep reading this because this is for your edification. But you can see how people in the Middle Ages, no matter what their religion, would look at this and say, here is the way we work out Scripture, what has been revealed to us by God, and make it sensible in the real world down here, the world of physical things. Okay, so those are aspects that I want you to remember for this class. I want you to remember the whole concept of mystery, that it's not just something that's hidden, that it's something that's pointing at something. I mean, by definition, there's something there behind the veil in a mystery. There is something there. So rather than just think of something that, well, it's a mystery, I don't, can't go there, what you have to do is strip away the veil. Okay? The whole business of the fact that all these mystics are borrowing from each other. Eckhart is borrowing from Maimonides. Some of the Jewish mystics that we looked at until the 19th century were thought to be Muslim. Right? Until the 19th century, when proof was adduced, were thought to be Muslim. Hildegard could be read by anybody, not just by Christians. All right. That's the formal part. I want to get into a kind of informal part now. Elizabeth, you missed the formal. Where did she go? Oh, there she is, down there. Come on, Elizabeth. Jeez. Please. Just don't ruin Gareth's sight lines. Okay. I want to do something that I've never done in a class before, so I can do this in the last class. And you've already handed in your evaluation. So you know. I'm going to talk about myself. Right? Because, Sarah, in fact, even though the pretense is that what I'm saying is something that you could get from any teacher anywhere, the fact is that I'm a human being with my own perspectives, and you should know something about them. Right. Okay? So.
Wait, you're human?
That I'm human. Sorry, Star.
My whole world is like crashing down right now.
Don't say like, Star. Star began as one of my worst students, and she remembers this a long time ago, always with the wisecracks, and she became one of the best students that I've ever had. All right. I was born in San Francisco on December 18th, 1943, so during the war, the only war we talk about of our generation. And we lived on Liberty Street near Mission Dolores. At 1 year old, I tumbled out of a third story landing into a garden and obviously survived. Either that or this is a very strange mystical class. My father's theory was I survived because the garden had just been dug up. And of course, in 1943, there were victory gardens, so you're looking at a survivor from the Second World War rather than a casualty. But we moved down to Burlingame shortly after that because of that incident, so all the houses were one story in Burlingame. And it was a very charming and pleasant town, as it still is. The problem was, while the good fathers of Burlingame allowed in Jews, probably reluctantly, there were no blacks or Asians allowed whatsoever. Yes, exactly. And it was a very safe environment, which was bad. But it's the kind of thing that many of us grew up in. My parents, as you might have also adduced, were devout Catholics. And I was raised a Catholic, and I still am. They were marvelous people, very generous people, but also not suited for the 20th century. Not suited at all for the 20th century. So obviously living in a town where there was no color whatsoever, they had no idea what the 20th century was about, and even less about the 21st. Both of them have died. So I went to parochial schools and got the same treatment from nuns that you've heard from other people. And now, what would it be, 55, almost 60 years later, I now sympathize with them enormously because they were not even suited for the 19th century, let alone the 20th century. And they had very good hearts, but none of this was making sense to them. none of the post-war America was making sense to them. The changes, the emphasis on wealth, Burlingame is in the shadow of Hillsborough. A lot of my fellow students were from extremely wealthy families in Hillsborough. The Stents, who owned the San Francisco Chronicle, the Molloys, who were Macy's, West. These were chief families, and they started giving their kids vast wealth, as it seemed to me as I was growing up. I went to a Jesuit high school in San Jose, Bellarmine. Graduated from Bellarmine in 61, went to a Jesuit college in Spokane, Washington, Gonzaga. It was unknown then, now it has a basketball team. It also, if there's a pattern to all this, was safe. I mean, yes, we had black students, we had Asian students, but it was nothing like the nation, and nothing like the nation was going to be. So the Catholicism was a kind of shell to protect many of us from the world. And in fact, I mentioned my experience at Medical Lake, and some of you were aghast that people were tied, not chained. I think I said chained. This is a mental health facility outside of Spokane where the people just sat on the floor and smoked cigarettes for their entire lives. And some of them were simply elderly people that the families didn't want to take care of anymore. There was nothing mentally wrong with them whatsoever. They weren't senile or anything. They were just thrown into the lap of society and the government. So when your parents start waxing nostalgic for something that was, do remind them that it was actually a pretty bad time. It was a bad time. And the changes of the 60s and 70s, while there were some important ones, it made me, especially since Vatican II, a radical Catholic. Nonetheless, that dead hand of Eisenhower and that comfort that the post-war period gave to this nation, most notably in Ronald Reagan, these things are terrible. These things are terrible. And Amanda isn't here for me to warn you once again that you're running into serious problems because of this, because people are too complacent for words about the environment, about their spiritual lives, and about humanity itself. All right, so that takes me through college. I went for a year to the University of Iowa to get my master's in English. I had graduated in English. Iowa is a very interesting place, and I wouldn't recommend anybody go there, especially you, again, Ari. It's a place that could not understand why a Californian would be there, basically. And I, in the end, agreed with them.